This is session number 44, side one, recorded on June 18th, 2007. And we ended with discussion interrupting our most recent Lyndon LaRouche quote. I'm going to finish the Lyndon LaRouche quote, and then Scott's going to go into some issues that came up in the discussion that we got aborted on. So this is an article written by LaRouche in 1991 called The Science of Christian Economy from the Executive Intelligence Review, Volume 18, Number 22. And it's in that article, it's pages, in that issue of the magazine, it's page 37 we're quoting from. And this is on page 74 of my book. Okay, now, re-examine the same historical connection from the vantage point of our earlier discussion of curvatures of physical space-time. Let us recognize thus that the approximate simultaneity of the collapse of the Anglo-American and Muscovite economic systems shows the convergence of effects of the two systems sharing in common certain among the most flawed axiomatic assumptions implicit in each. The history of European civilization, including the post-1492 Americas, is essentially, as Schiller portrays this, the struggle of republicanism, in brackets such as Solon's reforms in Athens, against the barbaric heritage of ancient Mesopotamia, which is usury-ridden oligarchism. British philosophical liberalism, the root of Hobbes, Locke, Hume, Bentham, Mills, and Smith's moral philosophy in quotes, and of 18th century British Haileybury political economy, Haileybury's in brackets, is in all essential features a utopian pantheistic ethical dogma modeled chiefly upon pagan imperial Rome, but also upon the ancient pantheistic Delphic cult of Gaia, Python, Dionysus, and Apollo, the principal forerunners of Delphic oligarchism in ancient Greece, is the so-called Babylonian, that's in quotes, the so-called Babylonian model of ancient Mesopotamia and Canaan. To adduce the relevant common axioms implicit in the collapses of the British and communist political economies, it is perhaps sufficient to compare British and communist dogmas of national and supranational economic practice with the following reference points in ancient and Renaissance history. We begin with a succession of usury-caused collapses of the ancient Mesopotamian, in quotes, bow tenure system of agriculture. We include reference to the circumstances of Solon's anti-usury reforms in Athens. We examine the crucial related issues associated successively with the Flammarion and Gracchi reforms of pre-imperial Rome. We include the process of collapse inhering in the axiomatic features of the pagan imperial Rome of Augustus, Tiberius, Nero, and Diocletian. So the quote I'm reading from, he's outlining what he's going to go into in a long article in detail. So this is like the introduction to the article, but it's a good summary of his worldview, his historical view. We examine the reasons for the upsurge of economic power generated by the Golden Renaissance and view this with a reflection upon the great enterprises set into motion by Charlemagne earlier. Two opposing features of these cases are emphasized, the role of usury and the issue of increase of the per capita productive powers of labor, scientific, and technological progress, which LaRouche thinks is not happening right now, or hasn't been happening in large part of the 20th century, at least since the Kennedy administration. And he goes on to say, the forms in which usury's systematic taking of unearned income, in brackets, i.e. theft, occurs may be reduced to three general subclassifications. First, there is simple usury, payment taken on account of debt, whether the original principal amount of that nominal debt may have been created in payment of money or real value advanced, or simply imposed upon the debtor either by fiat or kindred means. Second, there is the role of monopolies, for example, the International Grain Cartel, in brackets, in exacting usuriously unearned income from both producers and consumers of some essential commodity. Third, there are the sundry guises of ground rent usury in italics. We include among these the evolution in the modern British model of central banking and related forms of public indebtedness from roots in ancient tax farming. And he actually has from roots in ancient, in brackets, for example, example, Mesopotamian tax farming. We counterpose earned profit of physically productive enterprise. And he has earned profit and physically productive in italics. So we counterpose earned profit of physically productive enterprise to the merely nominally earned, in quotes, profit and interest of usurious activities. And profit and interest are in italics. We explain the necessity and functional basis for this distinction. I'll read that last bit again. We counterpose earned profit of physically productive enterprise to the merely nominally earned profit and interest of usurious activities. We explain the necessity and functional basis for this distinction. So that's what he's going to do in the article. So there he lays out his eternal pattern of usurious oligarchism versus non-usurious republicanism. And that's the eternal battle in history for LaRouche.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, so there's stuff to comment about that. Do you want to go back to what you mentioned at the beginning of the session? We were going to finish up something from last week.
Oh, yeah. You had a question about something.
Right.
And got cut off.
Yeah, because last week you had pointed out that the phonetic alphabet, because of its repeatable modular, the way that it's made.
No, that's mainly in the printing press phase.
Right. Yeah, well, I was sort of having to go back to what we were talking about last week. We were saying that evoked the idea of doing repeatable experiments in science.
Yeah, that's the printing press phase.
Yeah, the printing press phase, yeah.
But before that, the phonetic alphabet made a mobile little portable, efficient medium for creating empires over space.
Yeah, and you said that the printing press retrieved either Greek or Roman sensibilities, because like in Rome, they were, they were beginning to get pretty sophisticated in terms of development of math, empirical observations. They were developing technology, and then we fall into the Dark Ages, and I was about to question something when the tape ran out, which was that if in Rome they had the elites were in control of the phonetic alphabet, and if in the Dark Ages the elites were in control of the phonetic alphabet, but they both had the phonetic alphabet, and they were both writing in script. This was pre-printing press. Then how do we account for the fact that the Dark Ages were so different from Rome, where if in Rome they're beginning to do empirical observations and develop technology, and then in the Dark Ages, they fall into symbolic and mythological and religious idealism. You know, they quite the inverse. But they're both operating under the same phonetic alphabet, using the same script, like that. And
okay, so Rome collapses because Eumenes II, an Egyptian pharaoh, cuts off the papyrus to Rome. So Rome cannot have its vast center margin horizontal empire over space.
Now, how and why does he do that?
Why does Eumenes do that?
Yeah.
Probably angry at Rome. I don't know the particulars about why he did it.
Uh-huh.
I can't even, when I Google Eumenes II, I can't even find him. It doesn't give me much detail on him.
But you think he knew that without paper, it would without the papyrus to write on, that it would actually have catastrophic effect.
I don't know if he knew, but he knew that they needed it.
Uh-huh.
So because they didn't have it, and Rome therefore became decentralized, the what we call the Dark Ages, the leftover of that manuscript culture around the phonetic alphabet in Europe was preserved like a Noah's Ark in the monasteries, basically the Irish monasteries at first. Now, they during this period of, the, quote, the Dark Ages, there's no papyrus, so you don't have the visual space political system that Rome had. So it's actually no visual space in the Dark Ages. That's why they're dark. There's none of the light of the manuscript page. Or maybe that's a category we come up with after print, and with the printed book, it's white light. So the Dark Ages are non-visual space. It's a totally different culture. Now, we have lots of fantasies and legends about that period, like the Merovingians and the psychic stuff and myth and legend, maybe even King Arthur. The point is that the Dark Ages are not like Rome, because the monks are using the manuscript, but the general population doesn't experience that.
Mm-hmm.
They did experience the roads and paper routes that Rome did. So there is no visual space in Europe. There is visual space in Constantinople, and that's around 330. Constantine sets up the Christian religion as official state religion, and there's still a bit of papyrus, and so that keeps going on through the Dark Ages in Asia, I guess we call it, West Asia, the Orient, Middle East. But what happens around 800, 900 is the rise of Islam. And they create a powerful culture, and they actually get into visual space effects and make advancements in math and that. And it's that knowledge when the Muslims move over to Spain through the Moors and all that, coming out of what we call Algeria, that started to create a new visual space civilization, and expanding the monasteries, preserved books and manuscripts into the culture that LaRouche refers to when he says the great enterprise is set into motion by Charlemagne earlier. So just after Charlemagne comes and goes, but he started things going again with rudimentary technologies, and he hires the monks from England and Ireland. That is impregnated by the Renaissance coming out of Arabia and the Islamic Empire. So those hybrid forms set the ground for the Renaissance, and the Renaissance leads to the printing press. Pretty well happens around the same time, 1450. So the printing press then has as its content all these old manuscripts and the culture of Greece and Rome. And so that's what the Renaissance studies. But the invisible effects of the printing press is that it's the first mass-produced commodity. It's the first assembly line, because you can make something that is repeatable. It's exactly the same and repeatable. And that's a new kind of visual space. That's a very intense, exaggerated form of visual space, and creates the extreme visual abstraction that was only implied or partly available in the Greek and Roman period. So the eye is really exaggerated and really dominates, in McLuhan terms, after the printing press. So it's a different kind of visual space than either the Constantine's visual space or the Eastern Church in Istanbul, Constantinople, and the Arabian Renaissance. They're all pre-printing press. The printing press makes the real break. Historians of technological evolution see the rise of knowledge, around 1500, just quadruples whatever happened thousands of years before that.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the beginning of a Moore's Law problem or progress.
Yeah, you probably don't see that rapid of an increase in the dissemination of information until we get to the computer age.
Right. There is progress all the way along, but the Moore's Law world of our time is equal, a million times more than the Renaissance, but the same kind of ratio. The Renaissance to previous time is quite a leap, just like our time with the Internet and digital technology is a billion times leap compared to 100 years ago.
Yeah.
So that's the difference. So basically, the monasteries did not create a visual space environment. No one was experiencing it other than them, and they were just taking the manuscripts and copying them.
Mm-hmm.
So only they were literate, and they were probably not literate the way we think of illiterate.
Yeah, well, and they were focusing all their attention on copying the Bible, basically, so...
Yeah, and they made an incredible non-left hemisphere patterns of design. The arabesque, the complexity of the design of the manuscripts had retrieved some of that super sensitive oral culture kind of pattern recognition.
Mm-hmm.
So we look at the manuscripts and they look quite bizarre to us, unless you're trained in how to read them. But they are immediately impressive in their colorful, intricate weaving of the writing.
Yeah. Well, that evokes the idea of the Book of Kells, which was, I guess, out of, Ireland, huh?
Yeah.
And that was really wild stuff.
Yeah. The Terence McKenna gang would say these guys were smoking, you know, marijuana or something, and...
McLuhan was quite interested in the Book of Kells and the Celtic knot style of calligraphy and design.
Well, you can't say he was quite interested. To the degree he was interested in Joyce and Finnegan's Wake, he was forced to be interested in the Book of the Kells because Joyce modeled the sort of the design of Finnegan's Wake, one level of it, on the Book of Kells.
Mm-hmm.
So it was Joyce who would draw your attention to the Book of Kells.
Oh.
So he brought in that manuscript intricacy and delicacy in his design of Finnegan's Wake.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't limit it just to being a book. He includes other forms of media. But definitely on the level of a reference to a history of manuscripts, the Book of Kells is a model for Finnegan's Wake.
Mm. Well, remember that gal that Jerry met at the jazz show who was a student of McLuhan's?
Right.
Don Avalon, I think?
Yeah, I just actually was looking at her papers she sent me recently. Just came across them.
Oh, yeah. Well, she said that Marshall had assigned her, given her an assignment to investigate the Book of Kells. And she had divined and thought, apparently, that Marshall felt the same way, although we don't know what Marshall thought in relation to what she thought, that those...
She was a student. He was giving her a project. He gave me, you know, a project he gave me?
What?
Told me to go to Stratford-on-Avon.
Uh-huh.
In, you know, the hometown of Shakespeare. And I wasn't even a student. He just decided, I don't know, he had it on his mind, and I was around the office. Uh-huh. This was on April 20th, 1979, one of the last times I was with him in his office, because he had his stroke in September 1979. I saw him passing in a car in the summer, but he wasn't around the center much after April. And through the summer months, and then he didn't come back in September because he had the stroke. But he told me to go to Stratford-on-Avon and find all the people who can trace their ancestors back to Shakespeare's time and interview those people and get the oral tradition on the stories of what Shakespeare was like and what was passed down through the families and neighbors of Shakespeare, you know, 400 years before.
Oh.
So he was assigning people stuff all the time.
Did you do that?
No.
Bad.
I wasn't even a student. I mean, Dawn was a student. I mean, she could maybe make a paper out of it, but he was interested in millions of things. So you don't put any significant. But it is. He was interested in the oral tradition. So find out what the families around Shakespeare have.
She told me she believed and implied that Marshall believed it as well, but like I say, I don't know what Marshall believed in relation to what she thought, that the elaborate, I don't know how you would describe the way those lines all intertangle, like weavings, and sometimes they use them to actually, they'll like make letters out of these... loops and lines and things, but she thought that they represented some kind of circuitry that was, you know, like etheric bodies circuitry or something like that, and and there was something very esoteric and in all of that Celtic knot work.
Yeah, but McLuhan would be looking at any oral cultures and how they, to the degree they got into writing, like calligraphy in Asia, it's very subtle and aesthetic and different from the printing press writing. So he would notice
it's an inner trip.
Yeah, so the oral culture bounced off the visual effect of the alphabet and included acoustic simultaneity or acoustic sensitivities. Mm-hmm. So the interplay of the two was a balanced situation from McLuhan's point of view compared to the effect of the printing press, which totally tilted it to the eye. Now, McLuhan felt the 20th century was a balanced time because you had all the different media, extensions of our different senses, so we had a more comprehensive, multi-sensuous existence.
Mm-hmm.
So the manuscript of the Book of Kells would be symptomatic of a pre-print culture.
Yeah. And, of course, the Celtics were very esoteric and occult and mystical in there.
Yeah, there's lots of room for speculation there. Who knows what they were doing? That's what I say. McKenna's people would say they're probably taking a few.
I think they came out of the Druid tradition. I mean, the Druids had their own sort of Kabbalistic tree of life thing that they had developed along their own lines. And
Well, what's interesting in relation to LaRouche is LaRouche would not put any value on any of those factors, on those aesthetic design factors. He would consider them dupes of Aristotelian thought processes and never got anything progressed. That's why it was the Dark Ages.
Mm-hmm.
So LaRouche is interested in making better technologies, using more modern forms of communication to retrieve the idea level of the Christian culture.
Yeah.
He wouldn't make a fetish out of the designs. He considered McLuhan a media fetishist.
Right. Well, I was always under the impression that McLuhan liked the period of the illuminated manuscript because of the balance of the...
Yeah, well, he's not liking.
Yeah.
Of course, it's pleasurable, but he was pointing out that the culture of Greece, the medieval culture, and China culture all had the same interplay of eye and ear, but the West was a different eye and ear interplay than the Asian eye and ear,
mm-hmm.
because of the phonetic alphabet in the West, which created a more exaggerated emphasis on the eye than the Asian non-phonetic form of writing,
right.
The ideogrammic method. But so he would be looking at the patterns that pre-print cultures in general were similar over. So it's the principle of balance that McLuhan's talking about that happened in medieval culture that he, quote, unquote, liked.
Yeah.
But he was trying to point out the greatest age of culture, which was our time, and its balance.
Well, the thing about the alphabet and the printing press is that when you get the idea of modular, repeatable parts, and then you start, and that leads into the, you know, development of machinery and industrial revolution. That gets kinetic space revved up, because you didn't have trains and planes and you know, in Asia.
Well, it's eye and kinetic. It's a phoneticized kinetic space. So you invent these machines, the railways, steam engine, and you embed them and expand what has already been laid out for 200 years, the horizontal space imperialism engendered by the printing press. So you get an eye-foot. Eye is visual, foot is kinetic. Hyper-new situation.
Mm-hmm.
That's the Industrial Revolution. And the Chinese didn't have the... If they invented something, they'd destroy the inventor. They'd kill the machine. They had a sense of acoustic balance, or at least old-fashioned oral ecology, and they didn't want to upset what Harold Innes would call the time-based form of control.
Yeah.
Whereas the printing press is space-based.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the Chinese, I think they understood that the Earth revolved around the sun like 1,000 years before Galileo. They understood, I think they had gunpowder and all kinds of things, you know, centuries before the West. But they never got up and running with it the way we did.
Right. They were not phoneticized. That's McLuhan's theory. LaRouche would, since we're in the LaRouche zone, we'll bring him in. LaRouche would say there were other reasons. It was on the level of ideas and thinking. And Confucius had created a very healthy form of thinking that led to the technologies they developed. Maybe they had them before Confucius. But
LaRouche, he talked about the ancient mariners. Didn't he suggest they were Chinese? The mariners, long before the European guys, Columbus and Magellan and all those guys.
Yeah, maybe. I don't recall that. The point is, he's saying that the quality of various Chinese dynasties and their evolution technologically was determined by the thinking around the rulers of that phase of Chinese history.
Mm-hmm.
So he would not bring in the effects of media as McLuhan developed it.
Mm-hmm.
He calls that too much embedment in sensory environments and sensory effects, which is a kind of fetishism.
Right.
So we would look at today in our situation. I don't know if ideas do have the power that LaRouche says they have, because we have such a surfeit of sensory extensions around us that McLuhan seems to give the reasons why LaRouche's agenda wouldn't happen.
Well, you know, it depends on what you call an idea. If you call Google an idea, that certainly having tremendous impact.
Right, but LaRouche thinks that the whole computer world is exaggerated and creates minds that have no understanding of the history of what McLuhan would call visual space, because they're not retraced. And he says the gathering of facts is useless.
Yeah.
So he almost would see this as a dark age.
Yeah.
In terms of education.
Yeah. I think it is in general. I mean, the average person, you've seen Jay Leno go, his jaywalk, he walks down the street and asks, you know, people, you know, who was, the president, you know, of the United States 5 years ago, and nobody knows. I mean, those kinds of questions, you know. I mean, people don't know anything. So it's amazing. But then you still have, a consensus group of individuals who do keep, I've found some excellent books and references on history, and they're getting tighter and tighter. You know, historians are getting a tighter and tighter picture on, you know, more and more, putting more and more clues together and getting a better and better picture. The possibilities for education are greater than ever, but the average person is so solipsistically involved in the software media environment, they're having too much fun just, you know, surfing around, and they don't, you know, take these things seriously.
Yeah, have you ever heard of the Bayeux Tapestry?
No.
That was a huge rug, you could say, that in medieval times, European people, they'd have like knitting bees that people get together and sew the historical events of battles and that into this, you know, huge cloth.
Mm-hmm.
So the Bayeux Tapestry, that collective tribal or corporate activity of people as a joint enterprise, just like building the cathedrals, make these amazing, beautiful record of the historical culture in these rugs or mats, whatever you want to call them. McLuhan said that that was replayed by the newspaper environment. The Bayeux Tapestry was updated by the corporate weaving of the history of every day, 24/7, in newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
So then we would look at the...
But everybody throws yesterday's newspaper away, so they don't have a sense of continuity. The tapestry you're talking about, it's like all the whole newspaper environment's all in one tapestry. But, you know, today the newspaper... You only see the one day's worth of the newspaper's environment, and then you throw it away, so you don't see the whole thing knit together.
Well, no, you see it every day. And then the form of reading the newspaper is what's repeated. Not the content, but the form. And the form is like a Bayeux tapestry. And so I was saying, leading into the experience of people using Google or in the internet is an even more hyper form of Bayeux tapestry. It's a quantum tapestry because it keeps disappearing, and then you replenish it with new imagery. But the interweaving and Baroque spiraling of information before the printing press was represented by something like the Bayeux tapestry, which was another version of complex design like the manuscripts.
Yeah.
So the common factor of that period of the actual Bayeux tapestry in our present TV body and chip body experience of interweaving and Baroque spirals is the internet. So you can make common overall patterns to show that where we are today and where the Bayeux tapestry era was is completely different from the period from 1500 to 1800 when it was just print-based.
Mm-hmm.
So the art and culture is totally different in the Gutenberg galaxy and has a different way of looking at things than the pre-Gutenberg and the post-Gutenberg. So McLuhan would compare the stylistic forms of the present and what they resonated with in the past.
Yeah.
So that he would say the internet retrieves the Bayeux tapestry.
Mm-hmm.
Now, LaRouche he sees this Bayeux tapestry thing as a kind of lack of progress technologically, and so people become obsessive-compulsive and repeat the forms of their culture and basically run on the spot and get stuck in a rut.
Yeah.
So that the encyclopedism of the present-day consumer of information, they know a lot about different things, but they don't know anything in detail.
Exactly.
And those are... What?
Exactly, yeah.
And those are categories, but judging whether someone retains information may not be relevant anymore.
Mm.
So then we become what McLuhan predicted, robots. We go and interact in our jobs and in our computers and whatever we're doing digitally and electronically, and it's almost like a robotic ritual. This would be horrifying to LaRouche, that vision of where we are today.
Yeah, and, LaRouche, in the last week, I think we were talking about the Aquarian conspiracy, how he was really bashing them for trying to retrieve old ancient images, archetypal, archaic images of human beings, and then...
We know that McLuhan, it would make total sense to McLuhan that these things were retrieved, because they resonated
right with
the post-Gutenberg...
Yeah.
You know, Marconi era.
Yeah. But I think the important thing to distinguish is that pre-literate is not the same as post-literate. Post-literate is post-modern, and it's very different from pre-literate, although post-modern or post-literate retrieves a pre-literate sensibility. It's not a reversion. It's not reverting back.
It's just creating a deja vu of the aesthetics of the previous forms. This is what Terence McKenna did. He retrieved the aesthetics of the archaic revival, and he maybe imagined that we were heading to an archaic revival, but we weren't. It was impossible. And so the new situation was mass man, not tribal man, and McLuhan defined mass man as living at the speed of light, the simultaneous factor. Simultaneity, he called it, was so different from the medieval period. Medieval period was still linear moving forward because they had slightly Western culture.
Yeah.
And the effect of the phonetic alphabet. But definitely what we're seeing today is what some people would call virtual reality. It's not even involving the five senses. We're involving extensions of our senses which are maybe not categorizable. Barry Nevitt, McLuhan's associate, used to say that we had 14 senses now, not five. And you could think that, what were those extra senses? Well, listening to the radio. It's not the ear, but it's an electrified, discarnate version of the ear, and it's a new kind of experience, so it's a sense.
Yeah.
So just doing an inventory of the 14 senses shows how puny the pre-literate world was compared to ours.
Yeah.
And that's why McLuhan liked Finnegan's Wake, even though it was hard to read. It did point to the complexity of even categorization about where we were today.
Mm-hmm.
McLuhan would sum it up and say, hey, we live all times and places simultaneously right now.
Yeah.
Plus the ongoing newness of new data presented to you every day.
Mm-hmm.
So when I look at LaRouche, he's holding on to this political battle, and it seems so skimpy and thin compared to the exaggerated, excessive amounts of pleasure and involvement with all kinds of pictorial, musical, kinetic, tactile forms of sensory stimulation. Now, what's interesting, as we do, though, get into the shrinking, and this is what my chart will talk about, the shrinking of the electronic and the digital, to now the situation where we're like confronting each other one-on-one, at that point we might retrieve. And remember, the internet does have, as one of its urban legends or cliches, is that it's riddled with conspiracy theory, right?
Mm-hmm.
People say you want conspiracy theory, you go on the internet. So the conspiracy theory is an effect of the fact that we are equal to everybody else on the planet. We're all in the same situation, same access to the same repository of knowledge. So then the question of who's in charge comes up, and it would be very easy to say anybody who claims to be in charge, it would look conspiratorial, like a hijacking of the extremely democratic situation that the internet brings in terms of knowledge and experience. So then it does become an issue of what are the plans of the people who hijack the democratic situation. So LaRouche's information comes back and is retrieved as an issue of either you're going to move with newer technologies and not rely on oil, or if you do just rely on oil, then you're propping up a pagan, pantheistic, usurious historical oligarchism.
Mm-hmm.
So the actual effect of the internet retrieves a confrontational relationship to power. So power is under the scrutiny of everybody. We call them bloggers, the images of power. And what is the big issue, tease in the present primary debates is Ron Paul talking about the Federal Reserve, right?
Oh, yeah, I guess I'm not up on that issue. That's going on in the media right now.
Well, he was an old friend of Dr. Beter, Ron Paul.
He used to,
as a congressman, advocate that Fort Knox should be inventoried because he believed, like Beter, that there was no gold in Fort Knox.
Hmm.
So Ron Paul's always been in the conspiracy world, and he's been a congressman for many years, and he's introduced a bill to do something to the Federal Reserve, maybe dismantle it or something, can't remember exactly. But he's one of the Republican candidates, so he brings up these issues on the debates.
Hmm.
So that resonates. The conspiracy meme comes back in this imploded situation where there's only one thing in the Android meme, the White House, and every one of us is interacting with the White House image.
Hmm.
Everybody in the world on a one-to-one basis.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that, and money becomes an issue. What is, how do we measure the software communism we're in today, to use McLuhan's terms?
Mm-hmm.
So anyways, that's what's interesting about LaRouche's thinking, is that it is retrieved as relevant due to the effect of the media. So you have, or the effect of the internet, the latest medium. So you have an ecology of McLuhan explaining why LaRouche is retrieved.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, regardless of the issue of money, I mean, how do we evaluate the value of our environment?
Right.
You know, I hear China's, pumping open, you know, what, 10 new coal mines, coal burning factories a week or something like that. So, there comes a point where, you know, I don't know if you measure it in terms of money anymore, but you can certainly measure in terms of the deterioration of the environment.
Well, that's another big icon, eh? Global warming.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's true or not, or whether it's devastating in the future, what McLuhan would do was say, why does that iconic mood or image become such a prominent issue in politics? What is the technological ground doing to create a resonance with that image?
Well, maybe we're just getting hotter and getting, you know, when you start experiencing record temperature highs and it starts getting really uncomfortable, that's more than an image.
All right. It would bring in the fact that the digital environment affects nature, first nature. And the cycles of nature are altered by the rapidity of second nature cycles. So it may be a distortion of nature cycles, or that nature is speeding up their cycles to keep in touch with second nature. And it looks to us as chaotic, but it may not be as extreme as Al Gore presents it. Mm-hmm. It's just a chaos that's brought into nature as it modulates its seasonal turnover faster, keeping up with us.
Mm-hmm.
Well, with what we've made. And so regular scientists see that as a kind of chaos. And so if the four seasons happen in 6 weeks, then that's why it would snow in June. Because from nature's point of view, it's turning itself over as fast as we are digitally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's as good a theory as any. I mean, you got that one. You got the possibility that we're just pumping carbon monoxide into the atmosphere. You got the possibility that we're experiencing solar flares at a greater rate. You know, all these things people, scientists, are trying to make a case for.
Right, but meanwhile, everybody's looking at it as a big conspiracy from one level or another, and that's the effect of the Internet as a form.
Right. One thing about LaRouche in particular, probably true of McLuhan and the other guys in your chart, but the very fact that the guy's, where does his passion come from? I mean,
who, LaRouche?
Yeah, he never admits defeat, and yet he's defeated every step of the way, and probably has been for the last 20 years, but he never admits defeat, and he keeps on pushing his agenda. He stands there like a lighthouse in a storm. And never buckles, never gives up. It's kind of amazing. Where does that passion come from?
It could come from his astrology, from his astrological makeup. He's born September 8th.
Mm-hmm.
So what's that make him? A Virgo? Look up Virgo and find out. Maybe they're a kind of mind that likes information and ideas. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But anybody listening to this can Google Virgo and check it out for 5 minutes and then see what we're saying. But he's also running, he's an executive of a big corporation. Some people call it a cult.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see that he does have a vision of a historical pattern, and he can think up, you know, philosophical insights about it. So he likes to do that, and he has people believing what he's saying and waiting for his prophecy to unfold, which is the global collapse of everything financially. And then he thinks people will be interested in his panacea or correction. So he gets a lot of attention. So you can see a lot of personal, psychological, sociological reasons why he's high on what he's doing. He's a successful group enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
So he doesn't have to retire. Life is interesting for him. People
yeah.
want him to speak. He travels around the world.
He's probably much more interesting than we've even brought out. You know, I was talking to Matt a few weeks ago, and he was telling me how well-respected LaRouche is by, you know, big-time mucky-muck, you know, political figures in other countries, and, you know, how he's invited to speak in, you know, these different countries, and he draws, you know, really important people come to see him. They really want to know what he has to say. So he commands may possibly more respect outside of this country than he does in the United States.
Well, that's because in McLuhan terms, he, as the East goes West and the West goes East and the North goes South and the South goes North, you're talking third world. A lot of his fans are in third world countries who are hoping to industrialize and be like what has happened in North America, but do it better. And so he, and I have this is his position on my chart, he represents the second world. Russian bureaucracy is what second world is in terms of McLuhan's categories. But it is a semi-industrial, tribal approach to collective effects of new technology. And so LaRouche is old-fashioned here, but timely for the third world countries that are one phase behind us and just arriving in the 60s or so.
Mm-hmm.
So his imagery he puts out resonates with what they think they're doing and want to move towards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He has no audience in the United States.
Yeah. Well, Matt was pointing out how, you know, above and beyond just having a philosophy that excites some people to want to stand up and cheer, that, you know, when he goes to speak before these, you know, other parliaments and governments or, and, you know, these other countries, he has intimate, detailed knowledge of their legal structure. You know, he can cite laws by the code, by the number. He knows what's going on in their labor situations. He knows their language. It's as though he's been specializing in their particular...
Well, he has teams do that. When he goes and speaks in a country, it's usually because there are people who are members of the LaRouche Group who are working down there and working for Executive Intelligence Review, his magazine or his newspaper. I think it's called The New Federalist.
Mm-hmm.
Used to be the New Solidarity, I think. So people, you see that these people that write for these journals from Brazil or Africa or Asia, that they're the ones who bring in LaRouche to meetings with industrial people or professors in those countries.
Mm-hmm.
So it's those people brief him. He's like a chief executive briefed by his aides. But he has a global network, so he's briefed all over the place. That's why his newspaper is worth getting, just for if you're interested in international news, you'll learn a lot about things reading his paper.
Well, he's got to have a valuable perspective because he's taken the global mind into consideration. Most politicians are just taking their own tribe into consideration.
Right. But he...